This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
For up-to-the-moment Rhode Island news, follow at Bill Bartholomew on X.
Rhode Island has a higher density of cemeteries by 6 to 10 times than the other Atlantic Coast states. Based on historical databases, Rhode Island has about 3,200 cemeteries, of which 3,046 have been found and registered. Sadly, only about 500 are well-maintained. The rest are abandoned and overgrown in the woods. Since about 1958, about 1,704 cemeteries have been marked with the familiar white Rhode Island Historical Cemetery signs. In the 1950s, the Historic Cemeteries Commission was created to study the location, condition, and inventory of historical cemeteries throughout the state. In 2006, the state codified the commission's charge in the Rhode Island General Laws, and today, the commission participants are appointed by the governor for two-year terms. Each spring, the commission hosts cemetery awareness events to encourage cemetery preservation and historical research. Because of the popularity of the program, the commission expanded the event from 1 week to a two-month period. To celebrate Cemetery Awareness Weeks, we want to introduce you to a few not-so-famous people, but important people in our state's economic, cultural, and social history. Before we get started, I want to note that the Rhode Island Cemetery Database 1647 through 1900 contains over 421,000 inscriptions from 3,046 Rhode Island cemeteries, not including large Catholic cemeteries or some of the backyard burial grounds where the stones have no inscriptions. The earliest burial listed in the database is 1647. That's John Coggleshill, former governor of Rhode Island, and that's in Newport. It's extremely rare for a 17th century grave to be marked, perhaps 1 in 10,000. Breaking all of this down throughout the course of the next, really, several weeks as we roll out this vertical series here on Bartholomew Town is Deb Suggs, a commissioner with the Rhode Island Historical Cemeteries Commission and a historic preservationist with the Daughters of the American Revolution. All right, kicking off our series here for the next several weeks on historic cemetery two months here in Rhode Island, we begin with SK100, and that's known as the Joshua Teft Lot. Deb Suggs joins us, as she will, for each and every one of these episodes. Good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for having me and celebrating Historic Cemetery Preservation Months.
This is such a cool area, and it's living, well, I guess no pun intended or the irony of saying living history, but it's right there, it's real, and it's something that stories that oftentimes are forgotten can be reconnected, and we can start to learn not only about our state, but about really the history of the world in a broad context. Rhode Island is chock full of these historic cemeteries, and it's just, again, a really cool thing to check out. So 100 feet from the South County bike path lies SK Historical Cemetery 100, also known as the Joshua Teft Lot. The lot contains about 50 burials, all marked with field stones. That's the typical pre-revolutionary period marking, especially down in southern Rhode Island, where most people were buried on a family farm with little fanfare. Death was considered a daily part of life for most families due to disease, warfare, labor exploitation. And for most farmers, burying a family member did not interrupt their day-to-day battle for survival. However, there was nothing normal about the death of Joshua Teft on January 16th, 1676. Why is that?
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about Joshua Teft. And this is a fascinating story that probably a good portion of the people that live in South Kingston, never mind Rhode Island, don't know about. Joshua Teft, Teft family is one of the premier families in South Kingston. You see Teft everywhere, Teft Farm, Teft this, Teft that. They were one of the founding families. And they lived on this property, which off of the bike path, which is not the bike path back then, for about 14 years. That property was almost in the middle of the Great Swamp. So if you go to the Great Swamp, it's still swampy. It's still considered part of that property. Joshua and his brother lived down there for about 14 years. And then we've got the King Philip's War. King Philip's War in 1675, as you know, is the war between the colonists and the indigenous people of the area, specifically the Narragansett, but it was more than the Narragansett Wampanoags. It was literally all through New England. So, well, most of Joshua's family took off. They left. They went to Newport. They went to Providence to escape the war. Joshua decided to stay. He's got cattle. He's got things he's got to take care of. He was a sheep farmer. So when I say cattle, I mean sheep. He's got things he needs to protect there. And he had a friendly relationship with the Narragansetts who lived in the area. So friendly, in fact, that many said he had a common-law Narragansett wife. Might note, Joshua also had another wife, a colonist wife, who he sent up to Providence. The war is going on and on. Joshua's still friendly with the Narragansetts in his area. And in about December 1675, over 1,300 troops, the Puritan United Colonies. So really, believe it or not, there were Puritans here, but they fell under the troops coming out of Plymouth and Massachusetts. So it was still Mass Bay, that area, troops that came over. They converged on southern Rhode Island, Smith's Castle. Everybody should be familiar with Smith's Castle.
North Kingstown.
In North Kingston, yep. And they decided at that point to attack the Narragansetts. So they marched to the Great Swamp, which was where the Narragansett, primarily women, children, and elderly, were wintering. So they were wintering there. So it wasn't a soldier fortress, whatever. So we all hear about the Great Swamp Massacre, and it was a massacre with six, seven, 800 deaths of Narragansett citizens. What happened there during the fight was Joshua Teff's neighbor said, "Hey, I saw Joshua fighting on behalf of the Narragansetts."
Now there's talk of him maybe being somewhat of a traitor or
without
dual
doubt.
Loyalties.
Keep in mind that at this period, we are still British citizens. And treason is what it was. Treason is considered a punishable by death crime. It is a capital crime back then. So Joshua's neighbor said, "Hey, I saw Joshua fighting with the Narragansetts." Joshua was arrested. They took Joshua back to Smith's Castle, took him over to Providence. He said, "No, I wasn't fighting. They kidnapped me, and I was trying to escape. You just saw me with a weapon, but it wasn't me. I wasn't fighting." He was found guilty of treason.
And what's the punishment at that point in time?
So punishment at that time for treason was for a person to be hung, drawn, and quartered. And I don't know if you know what that means, Bill, but back then what they would do, and it wasn't commonplace. People think it was commonplace, but it was not a commonplace punishment even in Europe. What they did was they hung you till you were almost dead, and then they cut out your entrails. So you're almost dead, but not quite dead, so you can feel them cutting out your intestines and all this other stuff.
Yikes.
And then they quartered your body, sliced you. What they did with Joshua was they put his head on a spike and left it outside of Smith's Castle, warning everybody, this is what happens if you were found guilty of treason. The sad thing about Joshua, years later, the worst thing for Joshua's family is they took his property. You're found treason, your family loses the property. So the family, his wife and child, he did have a son with his colonist wife, were pretty much destitute. Couple of years later, they came back to court. Somebody said, "Hey, maybe the neighbor was lying." You know what? Joshua's not guilty. Conversation over.
A little late.
A little late for poor Joshua. The crazy thing is, after this was done, according to Mayor William Bradford, and he was the mayor of Plymouth, Mass Bay Colony, it was said it was done and done effectively. So Joshua was dead no matter if they found him not guilty or not. Family got some portions of the property back. It is a story, a tale that nobody knows about. If you go to the cemetery, and it's a beautiful walk around the cemetery, you will pass this 100 times if you don't look for the sign, because it is literally just rocks in a field. But look closely at those rocks, listen closely, and supposedly you can hear the cries of Joshua Teff.
Wow. What an incredible story. What a sad story. And what a window into history, you know. Almost a bit of a shocking truth, but an essential one, and something that everybody who's interested in this area broadly should check out.
Absolutely. What we know now, Bill, you know, after King Philip's War, everybody knows that indigenous populations were pretty much wiped out. Many of the remaining people, women and children particularly, were enslaved. I don't know if you know, one of the largest slave sales was of Narragansetts, and it was hosted by Roger Williams and his son in Newport. Mm-hmm. Many of those Native Americans were shipped down to the Bahamas, to Bermuda, areas like that, because you don't want to keep them in their same land. And Roger Williams himself ended up having a young boy slave who they said he treated like his son, but nonetheless, he was his indigenous slave.
Horrific, but important history to understand. These questions come up, or these issues ought to come up when we debate some of the most important questions about how we move forward with our state. I think back to work that you did on Providence plantations, and just the more informed people are, the more appropriately we can move forward. Deb Suggs, here we are. We're going to keep doing this every week. Stay tuned for our next edition, taking a look at the really incredible Rhode Island Historic Cemeteries.